Ukraine says its forces are taking back territory from Russian occupiers in the southern region of Kherson, prompting Russia to shift its tactics.
What we also can see that Russian forces are moving some of their troops from Donbas area to Kherson and Zaporizhia regions.
Plus, as Ukraine's first shipment of grain since Russia's full-scale invasion heads to Lebanon, a British Marine insurance specialist gives us his take on the operation.
It was successful, and another test is anticipated. So they will be learning from the mechanics of what happened during this voyage, the tug arrangements and the piloting.
Today is Thursday, August 4th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Michael Lippin, filling in for Steve Miller. Russia is pressing on with its offensive to seize all of eastern Ukraine's Donbas region, but it appears to be suffering setbacks in Ukraine's south. Reporter Anna Chernikova spoke to me today from the Ukrainian capital and told me what Ukrainian authorities have been saying about their counteroffensive in the Kherson region.
At least 53 settlements have already been liberated by the Ukrainian forces. This is official number, and of course, we don't get detailed information in advance or during the counteroffensive. We only get it something like 2 weeks later. So it could be considered that it might be more, but again, we talk about the confirmed number. Ukrainian forces continue quite successful actions, according again to the general staff. We can see that the bridge was almost destroyed, at least the main bridge in the Kherson region. At least it was, it is not functioning at the moment. And also, we can hear about certain Ukrainian continuing attacks on the storages of the Russian equipment and so on. What we also can see that Russian forces are moving some of their troops from Donbas area to Kherson and Zaporizhia regions. According to Institute for Study of War, they do this in order to strengthen their direction, these directions, their positions there, and they basically are getting ready for the defense. And this was also confirmed by the President of Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky. He also reported that Ukrainian army have noticed that Russian forces are moving.
What do we know about the progress of the Russian offensive in the Donbas area?
So as I already said, Donbas remains one of the main hotspots. Ukrainian army managed to defend its position, so we do not see any huge advances of the Russian forces. Russian forces have certain successes, but again, according to the international and Ukrainian intelligence, they're not quite huge. So basically, situation in the area remains more or less similar as it was weeks ago. But this area is under constant missiles attacks. And today, for instance, one of the cities was shelled by the Russian rockets, and unfortunately, civilians were killed and injured. And unfortunately, this is the situation, along the front line in Donbas area. We also hear that Ukrainian forces continue to control the village of Pisky, which is very close to the city of Donetsk. But again, reports from that area is that basically the hell is happening there, very heavy battles, and they are basically Ukrainians continue to defend this territory. But again, we can see very heavy fightings happening there.
Reporter Anna Chernikova, thank you for bringing us the latest on the situation from Kyiv.
Thank you.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is due to host his Turkish counterpart Recep Tayyip Erdogan for a meeting on Friday. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, Erdogan is seeking to expand a partnership with Putin on issues ranging from Ukraine to Syria.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Friday meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in the Black Sea resort of Sochi will be the second time the two leaders have met in a month. The meeting comes just after the first ship carrying Ukrainian grain left the Black Sea under a Turkey-UN brokered deal between Kyiv and Moscow. Analyst Ilhan Uzgel of the Duvar News Portal says Erdogan's success in brokering the UN deal and the Sochi meeting sends a powerful message to Turkey's Western allies about the Turkish leader.
It helps to ameliorate his troublemaker image internationally and regionally. He's still trying to show that he can make deals with Putin, showing to the United States, the Biden administration, that Putin is a close ally and close friend of Erdogan, that he can meet Putin twice a month.
Zal Gazimov, a professor of history at Bonn University and a specialist on Turkish-Russian relations, says with Ankara pursuing a balanced approach to the Ukrainian conflict, the grain deal will further deepen ties between Russia and Turkey.
The current Turkish-Russian relations have definite bonds with the current war in Ukraine. Ukraine wheat exports is a new chapter for the region, and Turkey plays a quite significant role as an intermediary and also a close military cooperation between Ukraine and Turkey, and the aspect of Turkey's not joining the anti-Russian sanctions. All that results in dynamics that are of importance both for Moscow and for Ankara.
Turkey-Russian relations are intertwined from North Africa to the Middle East to the Caucasus in a mixture of rivalries and cooperation. The two also have a deepening partnership on energy. Analyst Uzgel says Erdogan hopes the Sochi meeting will help resolve an impasse with Putin over Syria. The Turkish leader is looking to launch a major offensive against Syrian Kurdish forces, which Ankara accuses of being linked to an insurgency inside Turkey.
They have already met in Tehran 2 weeks ago. It seems that Erdogan could not get what he wanted from Putin, the permission for a Turkish incursion in northern Syria, where he openly stated the names of two places, Tel Rifat and Manbij. Most likely that he's looking for possibility to make such a military move into northern Syria.
Ankara needs Moscow's cooperation for its military operation, given that Russia controls Syrian airspace. Analyst Gazimov says Putin is wary of Turkey's growing military presence in Syria, but says the two leaders are experienced in managing differences.
Definitely, we see certain inconveniences on the both sides, but also the very huge readiness to discuss it with each other.
That readiness to talk and the growing list of common interests across the region means the frequent visits between the two leaders may become a regular thing. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The UN and Turkish-backed deal for Ukraine to export its grain from Black Sea ports free of Russian interference is facing another test. Reuters quotes a Ukrainian official as saying a Turkish cargo ship will arrive in the Ukrainian Black Sea port of Chornomorsk on Friday, in what would be the first such arrival of a vessel since Russia's full-scale invasion. The journey of the first cargo ship to leave a Ukrainian port with grain for an international customer is ongoing, with Lebanon as the destination. I asked Neil Roberts, a marine insurance specialist with the Lloyd's Market Association in London, what he thinks of the shipment's progress so far.
I think this was a proof of concept voyage, and it was successful. And another test is anticipated. So they will be learning from the mechanics of what happened during this voyage and the tug arrangements and the piloting and the testing and inspection. And once the concept is established and the SOPs are released, so the standard operating procedures for vessels transiting the corridor, then ships can start going inbound. At the moment, we're already seeing one or perhaps two vessels coming out.
What can you explain for our listeners about what procedures these vessels must operate under?
Well, it'll be about the timings. It'll be about the staying within the navigating limits set by the authorities on the width of the corridor. It's a condition of transit. They don't stray, that they don't have transfers, ship-to-ship transfers at any point. And should they go outside, then obviously they don't have the protection of the agreement. There'll be how it's inspected, when it's inspected. And obviously they're looking for vessels going in. They are looking for them to be empty. Originally, there was a plan for them to be inspected coming out, but I believe that's now been dropped.
When it comes to the vessels being empty, I guess we're talking about the vessels that are going to the Ukrainian ports to pick up the grain. Is that right?
Yeah, there's three materials in the scheme. So it's grain, other foodstuffs, and fertilizers, particularly ammonia.
Why is it important that the vessels that show up at the Ukrainian ports are empty at that point?
Well, in order to maximize the take, obviously there's 20 million tons estimated ashore in silos, and there's a new harvest coming in. The stuff that's in the fields is unprotected from the weather, so it makes sense to get it moving as fast as possible to minimize loss to the harvest. And of course, the more grain that comes out, the better it is for those countries that are short of supplies, particularly Middle East and Africa.
Now, this particular voyage of the Rosoni is the proof of concept or test voyage. What is your understanding about what comes next after this vessel's journey?
I think that there's be a time for analysis and reflection of that voyage. There'll probably be another proofing voyage. And once that's done, then they can refer those to the JCC in Istanbul, the Joint Coordination Center, who approve all the vessels that will be transiting this corridor.
The Joint Coordination Center did say today that it's going to have to fine-tune its procedures and processes to enable more safe passage of commercial vessels. What kinds of fine-tuning do you think we're going to see here?
To be honest, I don't know. It depends what they've learned from the test voyage. One would imagine it'd be about who's talking to who and when. And, good lines of communication, more than likely, because the mechanics of trade are well understood. But this is against the background of a conflict and a very specific agreement, remarkable agreement, given the context. And it's about staying within the terms of that agreement.
What, in your opinion, makes this such a remarkable agreement?
Well, there's no parallel that I can find where two combatants have agreed for a marine corridor in a live conflict. During wars, there is occasional trade between parties. We saw that in World War I, for example, Kashmir and elsewhere. But this is in a live combat zone, and there is no long-term peace envisaged at this time. So this is a very limited deal in a very limited area for 120 days, although it does automatically renew if the parties don't object. So it's about a specific humanitarian exercise to get the grain out and help the global south.
Given that the hostilities between Russia and Ukraine are ongoing, what do you think are the prospects that this deal will last?
Actually, it's looking quite good at this time. It's best to be cautious, and things will not develop quickly. It has to be one step at a time and taken very carefully. But it's in the interests of both sides to trade their grain, and it's in the interests of both sides to add to their reputation by assisting this humanitarian process, which was put in place by the World Food Programme under the aegis of the UN.
We'll hear more of my conversation with Neil Roberts, head of Marine and Aviation with the Lloyd's Market Association, in tomorrow's program. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Michael Lippin. The U.S. Treasury and State Departments issued new sanctions on Tuesday, targeting dozens of Russian individuals and entities as part of a months-long effort to hold President Putin and his allies accountable for their war against Ukraine. One of the most high-profile targets of the latest sanctions is Putin's alleged girlfriend, Alina Kabaeva, a former Olympic champion gymnast who now chairs a Russian media conglomerate. Douglas Redeker is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former U.S. executive board member at the International Monetary Fund. He gave me his assessment of the significance of the new U.S. sanctions.
Well, these are one step up from what are generally considered to be maintenance sanctions. Maintenance sanctions means you take the existing sanctions and you tweak them when the guy you're sanctioning finds a way around them. Sometimes they use their brother-in-law or their cousin, and so you try and expand them. That's a maintenance sanction. That's something that is often done. This is one step more than that, but it's not really a material change in the U.S. or the EU or the G7 sanctions policy against Russia, meaning we fired the big guns of sanctions at the earlier stages of the war in Ukraine. And what's happened since then has been incremental and largely intended to demonstrate we are still paying attention. We are still trying to turn the screws more and more. But the screw is largely in place. And so while there are some headlines that will be grabbed by Putin's mistress being named, the actual impact on the war, the impact on sanctions policy, on Russia's economy is fairly de minimis.
You mentioned big guns that were targeted earlier on during this conflict. What were those big guns?
Well, the big guns early on included the freezing of Russia's central bank reserves, the inclusion of Russian oligarchs in seizing some of their properties in the U.S. and in Europe and elsewhere. The limitations on correspondent banking, which severely limited the Russian financial system's ability to interact with international banks, including but not limited to the U.S. And the one that's the most important but the hardest to actually see manifesting in short-term impact was what's called the Foreign Direct Product Rule implemented under the Export Control Act. What that basically meant was the U.S. put a freeze on any high-tech semiconductor chip being imported into Russia from anywhere in the world. And that's really important because it means it not only impacts Russia's ability to conduct its general economic activities now, but Russia had a plan to migrate itself away from being a commodities-based, fossil fuel-based economy into something more high-tech. And the U.S. effectively put a kibosh on that and said, not so fast. And the U.S. effectively has a monopoly or a quasi-monopoly on those chips because it is U.S. intellectual property that goes into the hardware, those chips themselves. And if you put a limit on anything that has U.S. intellectual property on it, that really presents a very high hurdle for Russia to get over. But it takes time. And that's why I think for the public, they want to see something that happens in real time. But we don't have the ability using sanctions or other economic tools to have the same level of immediate impact on Russia as they do if they're firing bombs and missiles on Ukraine. So there is an asymmetry in terms of timing, even though the big sanctions that we rolled out were really meaningful to deteriorate Russia's overall economy over the medium and long term. It's just you don't see it on a day-to-day basis.
Well, what evidence have you seen in the last couple of weeks and months that the big gun sanctions that were rolled out earlier have actually had some impact?
Well, it's hard to tell what the real level of economic activity in Russia actually is because we don't have visibility beyond what the Russians are telling us and telling the world. There was a Yale University study that came out last week that tried to go through a lot of what they see as the anecdotal evidence, putting it together in one piece to demonstrate that there has been a significant deterioration in the Russian economy as a result of our sanctions. But the easiest way to look at the impact of sanctions would be on the day-to-day lives of Russian citizens. So we immediately after the sanctions came into place saw a massive deterioration in the value of the ruble, and that has rebounded and gained some in the interim. Why is that? Well, because if they're not able to import stuff and they are still able to export stuff, largely oil and gas, then you're going to see strength in the ruble, especially because we've limited severely the ability for them to use their reserves for the purposes of general central banking purposes. So it's not a good barometer. The fact that the ruble is as strong, if not stronger than it was before, is not a good benchmark, but it's one that a lot of people look at and say, oh, sanctions aren't working. I think that's misleading. I think the real way to look at this is You've got the Russian central bank that has imposed enormous capital controls, enormous restrictions on what Russians can and can't do in using their savings. You've got companies that have withdrawn from Russia. Products are no longer on the shelves. Russians do not have the choices that they had 6 months ago in terms of what they can buy, where they can go, how they can use their savings. Having said that, Russia is historically used to weathering a lot of externally generated pressure. And, you know, they are getting a different media feed than we are in this country. So they are rallying behind their president for the most part and willing to absorb a lot of the economic costs, even if longer term, that's probably not sustainable.
You've been listening to Douglas Redeker of the Brookings Institution. We'll continue that conversation with him tomorrow as well. Russia's war on Ukraine has put the Russian Jewish community in a difficult position. It has not explicitly supported the war, undermining Putin's claim that Russian forces are on a mission to denazify Ukraine. Many Jews in Russia also have chosen to leave the country. Marcus Harton has more in this report from VOA's Moscow Bureau.
Jews make up one of the smallest minorities in Russia, but the sense of community with the rest of the Jewish population in the territories of the former Soviet Union is very strong, or was. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has caused an emotional and political fracture between Russian and Ukrainian Jews. That is how Boris Gorin, chairman of the board at the Jewish Museum and Tolerance Center in Moscow, sees it.
I would say that I see at a personal level a deterioration of relations between the Russian and Ukrainian Jews. In other words, the politically active Ukrainian Jews tend to blame the Russian Jews that they do not protest enough against the invasion of Ukraine.
Among those who did protest was the man who for 30 years served as chief rabbi of Moscow, Pinchas Goldschmidt. He openly criticized Putin's military adventure and ultimately had to leave the country. Goldschmidt, now in Israel, has expressed pessimism about the future, telling reporters recently, there are many dark clouds on the horizon for Russian Jews. For some, nothing guarantees that the anti-Semitism seen during the Soviet era will not return. Oleg Melamed is a historian, also at the Jewish Museum and Tolerance Center.
What was going on during, say, the catastrophe of those years, it might happen in any place or time. It does not depend on whether we remember it.
During the last decade, the Jewish community in Russia has grown remarkably. Many families who left for Israel in the 1990s decided to return. Kindergartens, like this one on the outskirts of Moscow, and other Jewish cultural centers are evidence of a growing population. But it appears this trend has turned since Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
After the beginning of Russia's special operation in Ukraine, economic, political, and all other factors led to a huge amount of people who either left or started thinking of leaving.
Some Jewish families who have or are eligible for Israeli citizenship are now wondering if Russia is still the best place for their children.
We're open to all ideas, but Russia has currently changed drastically. I have no idea how it will all progress in the future in light of the latest events. Before February, it was comfortable living in Russia. Moscow is among the well-developed cities.
Jews who are against the Russian military operation in Ukraine cannot say it openly on camera. Like for other Russians, the risk is high, but they are saying it with their actions, leaving the country by the thousands since last February. For the VOA Moscow Bureau, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
That brings us to the end of today's program. There's more VOA coverage of Ukraine 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. On behalf of the Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Lippin. Good night from Washington.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.